On Wednesday, July 24th, we spoke with a Connecticut mother who would not take no for an answer when it came to passing a new drug law in the state. We checked in with Professor Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University, about his new book on Connecticut's political future and the 2018 gubernatorial election. And Bill Dunlap, law professor at Quinnipiac University, also checked in on the testimony of Robert Mueller in front of Congress.
Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And we thank you. 2 hours down, two to go. You know where to get us. WICC 600, always on the air here, Monday through Friday, 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. Also online at WICC600.com. The aforementioned Paul Pacelli here on this side of the glass, Aaron Johnson on the other side. We're 203-333-9422. In the deluge of stuff that we had going on toward the end of the General Assembly session, we were incessantly talking about tolls, we were talking about legalization of marijuana, taxes and all that. There was a bill that was signed that really got very little media coverage. You really had to hunt around to find it. It reclassified or classified fentanyl as a narcotic, and I was among the people who were rather surprised that a bill had to be passed to do this. Joining me right now is Fiona Coleman-Farim. Her family, along with others, were very instrumental in getting this passed on an incredibly short time frame after her family was touched by a death caused by fentanyl. Fiona, hi, how are you? Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Paul. Thank you so much for reaching out and inviting me.
I'm so glad, for Fiona, you could get this time out of your busy day, because I saw this story and I was, number one, I was intrigued, because as bad as fentanyl is, it had to have this reclassification in order that the people who sell it would be, subjected to harsher penalties. But this has a very personal connection to you. Talk about that.
Yes, it does, Paul. So when we had our first child, it was a little group of friends who lived in a condo complex in Hamden, mm-hmm. and we all had children. We all became friends, and one of my friends was Cameron's mom, and we stayed friendly. She moved back to Lancaster when Cameron was a baby, but we remained very, very close friends, you know, even in the days before social media, mm-hmm. We talked a lot. And when Cameron was 13, they lived sort of a very upper middle class life in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. When Cameron was 13, his dad died very suddenly on his 13th birthday of a massive heart attack.
Oh.
Very traumatizing for him. Within about 2 weeks, his grandfather, who had stepped in to help father him, also passed away. His grandmother became ill. And to add to this, unbeknownst to us, his mom had also become an alcoholic. Mm. And the stigma was so great to that, that it wasn't okay to talk about it. You know, she was like the perfect PTO mom during the day, and Cameron was suffering at night with this mom. So he was also a very promising young football player. Mm-hmm. And at age 14, he had an injury. So, you know, a year after his dad's gone, now the house is in chaos. And the family doctor did what would be pretty common at that time. At age 14, he prescribed OxyContin for Cameron for that injury.
Wow.
And as we know now, that the damage to a developing brain was almost, I almost want to say it was irretrievable.
Yeah.
By age 15, Cameron was in rehabilitation for the first of many times, age 15. At age 17, his mom died of acute alcohol poisoning.
Wow.
And Cameron was sort of moving around between extended relatives and friends and an aunt so he could finish high school. But two things had happened. One, in the last year of her life, my friend had said to me, with no particular reason, no forewarning of what was going to happen, but she said, if anything ever happens to me, please promise me you'll look out for Cameron. And Cameron didn't know that. And after his mom died, after the funeral, he sent my husband and I a little Facebook message, very sad little message, in which she said, could I ask you guys to be my family?
Oh.
So for us, from that day on, we have four biological children, but Cameron became our child. I mean, our children, too, didn't consider him any differently than anybody else.
Sure.
Cameron struggled, so this was a struggle of quite a few years. He fought this with everything he had. You know, you get to witness that addiction really is not a choice at this, that it's not something they want to do. They hate when they give into that. OxyContin, of course, remained the constant. There were periods of time where he couldn't afford that. He would then resort to heroin, which is very common. There were quite a few rehabilitation tries. There were, you know, quite a lot of therapy. And then in the early fall of 2017, mm-hmm. No matter where Cameron was, we talked to him every single day. My husband and I talked to him every single day.
Sure, yeah.
You know, he would come stay with us whenever he could, or... But we talked to him every single day, and he was always so honest with us. When he slipped, he would tell us. I mean, he just was a very open and a very loving young man. So in the fall of 2017, he actually called my husband at work, and he said to him, Joe, I'm in a bad way. I'm feeling so depressed. I'm scared. And I've relapsed. Can I please come to you? And, you know, it was that stage, Paul, where, you know, as the children start to leave the nest, you think this is it, they're really gone, and
yeah,
then all
yeah.
of a sudden they're back. So my husband didn't actually even take time to call me and tell me that Cameron was coming back to live with us. He just left and went to get him. And so Cameron came back, and I was shocked when I saw him. You know, he looked incredibly sad, incredibly frail. So we started immediately sort of navigating that system on getting him the help he needed.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily for us, New Haven was pretty responsive on that. Connecticut Mental Health, for anybody who has a child in the New Haven area who's struggling, I cannot say enough about Connecticut Mental Health.
My ex-wife used to work there, and they're a wonderful place. Yeah, they really are. Yeah,
wonderful place. So Cameron... But then went on to achieve things which might have just been a dream to him, right? So, you know, he moved in with us. So there were some, he moved back in. So there were some jokes about that. You know, when a child comes back to live with a family and they're a bit older, you know, there's kind of an adjustment period there, mm-hmm. right? Like, so, we now had to be the stricter parents.
Sure.
And, yeah. But he was great. He mm-hmm. was great. So he really... really, with the support of Connecticut Mental Health, really achieved complete sobriety. He became the head chef for a restaurant in New Haven. Never missed a day, never called out. He was adored. It was very important to him to go back to college because he had dropped out of college his first year when his addiction had really reared up.
Wow.
So he went back to college. Everything that you can think of that looked like he was... going in the right direction was there. He had regular therapy at Connecticut Mental Health a couple times a week. He never missed a session. They absolutely mm-hmm. adored him.
We pick up the story, Fiona, where, you know, your son had looked like he was rebounding from
right.
an oxycodone, OxyContin addiction.
Right.
Things were going well, and then what happened?
So what happened is that week, whatever happened, it happened very quickly. He had therapy on the Wednesday. Everything was fine. There were no signs this was coming. On the morning of Sunday, March 18th, it sort of began like every other morning. Cameron knew that we were going to be out most of that day, my husband and I and my daughter, because there were four of us in the house now. So he was... I'd seen him the night before. About midnight, he'd been sitting in a chair reading. I'd said goodnight to him. I didn't pick up on anything being amiss. The next day, we didn't wake him up because we would let him sleep in on Sundays. And we went out, did our whatever we had to do that day, came back. My husband started to make supper and realized Cameron was still in his room, which wasn't quite out of the ordinary for him, but he sent my daughter in to get him. And, well, of course, when Isabel went into Cameron's bedroom, Cameron was dead on the bedroom floor. So it was a pretty horrifying scene. Your house turns into a crime scene, as it should. Even the medical examiner, they're so understaffed that they actually, poor Cameron had to be on his bedroom floor for hours. It's a pretty horrible scene. So to us, Paul, now there was a police investigation, and we were sure that people would be questioned, apprehended. I just want to tell you that we're 90% positive that Cameron asked somebody if he could buy OxyContin. He must have slipped and started struggling in his mind.
Yeah.
What he took, there were three pills. He took one, and it was fentanyl, five times the dose that would kill you instantly. The medical examiner says he was gone before he even hit the bedroom floor.
Wow.
Yeah. So he, you know, yes, he made a decision and he slipped to take something. He certainly didn't know he was taking that. So we kind of went our way through the police investigation, waiting, giving those folks time. They're very busy. And then they came back and said they couldn't do anything. So we asked for a meeting with the sergeant. And at this point, we were incensed, and he started to explain that fentanyl was an artificial opioid, so it did not carry the same penalties as other narcotics, which, excuse me, but blew my mind.
So they told you that because, Fiona, it's essentially created in a lab or by drug people, it was in a different classification.
Correct. Absolutely correct. So the poor sergeant, I mean, we grilled him, but we were not willing to accept that because to us, Paul, I'm going to be quite honest.
No, go ahead.
It to me, it's murder. If you sell somebody something and tell them it's one thing and you know that you're selling them something that's a death sentence, it's really murder. I mean, you know, if it were anything other than a drug we were talking about.
Sure.
Right. So,
and I guess from what I'm, some of the background stuff I read, Fiona, it was some of this stuff is 100 times stronger than morphine, 50 times stronger than heroin.
Yes. I did have Narcan in the house because of when Cameron had first come back to us and he was going through withdrawal. And, of course, I've agonized over that. The medical examiner has told me and told me and told me again, had I been next to Cameron as he took that pill, I still couldn't have resuscitated him, and that's how strong it was. So we met with the sergeant and went back and forth on, you know, this can't be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this was if Cameron had gotten into a car with somebody who was heavily intoxicated and they had crashed the car and they had killed Cameron, that person would have been arrested immediately. Nobody would have said, well, they're an alcoholic.
Yeah.
So the sergeant finally said to us, look, we're trying to do everything can. We don't have the laws to back us up. The only thing I can recommend you do is you get some parents and you go to Hartford and you start demanding a stricter law. So at this point, it's a very isolating thing. The stigma is huge. So people aren't really willing to talk about it. Even people you're close to are very uncomfortable when you bring up death by overdose.
Oh, sure, because obviously, Fiona, you're worried about people are going to mumble, okay, well, couldn't they do anything? How could this happen? Sure.
Or didn't they know he was an addict? That was said to me multiple times, but you knew he was an addict, as if that. So I actually just researched on the internet, and I found two parents who had lost a child in 2018 to fentanyl, and I reached out to both of them. Now, ironically, I had reached out to talk to them the week before we met with the sergeant.
Really?
Yeah. So then when the sergeant said, the only thing you can do is get a law, I called each of them I don't even think Sergeant had pulled out of the driveway. Mm-hmm. And I called each of them and said, he says we need a law. And they didn't even hesitate. They said, all right.
Fiona, there were some people, and I read some letters to the editor and some editorials about this. You did have, maybe not so much from the actual people who voted on this, but there was some opposition to this, right?
Correct. There was. You know, I think that people are looking at it from a position of that we are in the throes of an addiction crisis. And if someone's addicted, is it going to help to increase the legal penalties? And our thoughts on that were, we are not talking. If two addicts shoot up a drug together, and one dies and the other doesn't, we are not saying that that person should face a jail sentence. They should probably face penalties and be rehabilitated. We're talking about people who are dealing drugs as a supplemental or as an income, particularly fentanyl, because they really know that they are handing off a death sentence. And I do just quickly want to mention,
sure,
to Paul,
yeah,
Themis Claridis had actually written this bill and brought it to the floor a couple times before, and it had been voted down. And it was when we went to Hartford and spoke to her and many others that they resurrected the bill and got it to the floor. I think the fentanyl crisis crept up on Connecticut so quickly, nobody saw it coming.
And you know what, Fiona? I think there are people who see a drug and they say, oh yeah, fentanyl, oh yeah, oxycodone, oh yeah, cocaine, yeah, marijuana. There is a misconception, Fiona, I think, from a lot of people that don't understand how a couple of grains of this stuff,
correct,
can kill a fully grown person.
Correct.
We're not talking about smoking weed or doing a couple of,
correct,
hits of cocaine. This is insidiously strong.
Insidiously strong. And nobody is asking. Nobody, no matter how addicted they are, is going to a dealer and saying, please give me this lethal dose of fentanyl, Paul. They're thinking, they're being told that it's something else. And dealers do prey on those who are suffering from addiction. I've seen it firsthand, mm-hmm, over years in Cameron's Texas. They do prey on them. So if you want a medical breakdown, I believe it's 3 to 5 milligrams is deadly, non-recoverable, and the level in Cameron's body not even fully absorbed because he died so quickly. They say he was died before he even had reached his bedroom floor, was 11 milligrams. So that gives you,
wow,
an idea of how strong.
That's just amazing. You know, Fiona, you, the rest of your family, the other families, your husband Joe, longtime friend of mine, high school classmate, have you sat back and really, I know it's been hectic for you, you're still recovering from the death, but do you realize what you did? I mean, how fast you got this done? If somebody would have told me that the regular common folk, the non-legislators, could get a bill passed, even if it was previously introduced, could get it resurrected and passed in 3 weeks, I would have told them they were crazy.
We haven't absorbed it yet. I'm not going to be honest with you. It has been so emotional. And to just keep telling the story and clutching the photograph of your kid, I don't think that this is fully... I don't think the long-term ramifications of what this could do have been fully absorbed by any of the three families as of yet, because it didn't seem real to us until we watched the governor sign it in last Wednesday.
I know, I saw that picture with your family members there, and the other two families that,
yeah,
had been, and you were all clutching photos of loved,
yeah,
ones, and then when I saw the connection with you and Joe, and I said, I have to make sure that people hear about this, because, you know, hey, part of my job, I get paid to be jaded every day, you know, but good things can happen if good people act in the common decency of a country or a state.
Well, you know, in the face of the worst tragedy, what came to us is the only thing we could do. Cameron hoped to become a therapist to help other people through his multiple losses and crises he had faced in his own young life. So what came to us is that the only thing that we could do now is to try to represent him by making a change for others. And, Paul, I don't think we're finished yet. I think there's layers and layers of this that we'll probably still be working on, mm-hmm. but this is such a strong step forward just to know that there is going to be a law in place, because it just seemed to us a real travesty of justice that there wasn't.
Fiona, thank you. And if you're pushing this any further with any further legislation, if this is going to become a cause for you and your family members, you have my number. You've got our producer number here. So anytime you want to come back on it and maybe give us an update as to what might be happening or a progress report, feel free to do that. We'd love to have you back.
I really, really appreciate this, especially in this day and age where a lot of people aren't willing to talk about it because of the stigma. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thanks, Fiona. We appreciate it. Stay close. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Fiona Cullinan-Farine, there you go, folks.
Listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And according to our next guest, Connecticut today, tomorrow, maybe in the next few years, maybe at a turning point. The name of the new book, Connecticut in Crisis: Policy Challenges and the 2018 Contest for Governor. We welcome back to Connecticut Today Sacred Heart University political science professor, Dr. Gary Rose. Gary, how are you?
Hi, Paul. How you doing?
What made you write this thing? It's bad enough that was this like a self-immolation thing of having to go through this? But in all honesty, I know you wrote this because you care.
That's largely the reason. Yes, I knew that we were having obviously a number of problems, you know, that were afflicting Connecticut over the past, you know, not just during the Malloy era, but really during the past couple decades, these things have been building. And with the governor's race about to begin, I really felt that it was time for someone who had been studying Connecticut politics for some time, that is me, I felt it was time to really delve deeply into what is really affecting our state. And in many ways, it is a call to action that, look, you know, it's time to really address this, because our state is not just in trouble. It is really now in what I consider to be a state of crisis. And I really did come to that conclusion. And, you know, looking at all the evidence, all the studies that have been done on Connecticut taxation, our infrastructure, our entitlements, our pension liabilities, I felt it was time for me to really call our lawmakers' attention to just how serious these issues are. And more broadly, I wanted to educate the public about how important these issues are.
You know, I tend to work all over the Northeast in radio, do stuff sports related and others. And anytime I occasionally will meet somebody, Gary, who, you know, didn't grow up here, but, you know, followed Connecticut over the years from New Jersey to New York. And invariably we'll get down a discussion like this, and invariably a question will be asked, something akin to, quote, what the hell is wrong with your state? What happened? Unquote. You know, they can remember when, you know, Gary, up through the 70s, 80s, and even early 90s, we had a robust economy. We were considered somewhat of a tax haven. We had a balanced legislature, a balanced congressional representative. And it seems like from the early 90s on to where we are today, Gary, it's been a slip slide, one right after the other.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And it really is, in many ways, you know, a confluence of developments politically, mm-hmm. economically, socially. It all has come together, which I think has really put a great deal of strain on our state. And I can't just blame, you know, one party for this. Quite frankly, I think that, you know, it spans the spectrum on our party system, and it spans the governors who have served this state as well, and the leadership in both the House and the Senate up in Hartford. And so, you know, this is not a work that is blaming mm-hmm. someone for these problems. It is a work that really shows that over the years these problems problems have just really come together, and now our state is rated so low in the area of infrastructure, you know,
business friendliness, not, things like that.
We are not business friendly. We're rated extremely high on the rates of taxation, and, you know, entitlements and pension liabilities, like I said. So it's just a whole range of issues that have been really developing and evolving into this situation over the past several decades.
People,
and you're right. We used to be a model state.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, I tell people who are kind of on the younger side, and I forward them some late. There was a great Fortune magazine piece done about 3 or 4 years ago. Other magazines who said, you know, at the time, Gary, you and I can remember, and a lot of people listening here, Connecticut, well, part of the reason we had so many corporate headquarters here, right, was because of, believe it or not, the tax advantages we had.
That's right. You know, and another reason I think I wrote this book is because I have so many students, and I know of so many young people, not just at my university but elsewhere, who say when they get out of college, they are heading out. They are leaving, and they just don't find Connecticut to be a land of opportunity like it once was. And so that's another reason, and you're right. Connecticut at one time, you know, for a whole range of issues, was the place to go, and now it's the place to leave. And I really feel that we're in a state of crisis, and I think that this is a clarion call to action.
One of the things, obviously, that you and I talk about all the time, and no doubt I would assume you touched on it in the book, is in fact, for example, financial things like our pension obligations. I mean, it's a classic case, Gary, of keep kicking the can, you know, down the road until suddenly you have a brick wall in front of you and there's nowhere to kick the can anymore.
Oh, the pension liabilities is, you know, as one, I know, candidate for governor said at a debate that I moderated, and which I was a panelist, he said that's the elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. And he said that's something that if we don't get under control, then so much else is going to be afflicted by those pension liabilities. They consume so much of our resources up in Hartford, the budget, you know, the fixed costs and so forth, the deals that have been cut between the public employee unions and, of course, governors. And just recently, you know, Lamont also made some arrangements with CBAC. And so, mm-hmm. No, that's one of the big issues. It's not the only issue, but boy, it is a big one. Yes.
Guest, by the way, is Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University, new book regarding the future of Connecticut that went into his analysis of the governor's race in 2018, Connecticut in Crisis, Policy Challenges, and the 2018 contest for governor. Gary, to what do you ascribe the old phrase, well, voters get the government they deserve? To what extent does this end up, whatever we're going through right now, at the feet of the people who cast ballots over the past 30 or 40 years?
Yeah, it is true. Again, I can't blame just one party, but it is true that we have been electing governors and state legislators over the years who seem, more concerned about benefits for people here in the state, as opposed to really shrinking the size of government, mm-hmm. and shrinking taxes, cutting taxes. And because, you know, that helps people get reelected.
Sure.
You know, this pork barrel legislation that you hear about, and how we spend money to serve districts and so forth. And it really is, it's like they really haven't addressed the big core issues. Instead, there's so many short-term solutions, many of which are politically motivated in order to ensure re-election.
And the guest, Dr. Gary Rose, political science professor, Sacred Heart University, new book, Connecticut in Crisis, Policy Challenges, and the 2018 contest for governor. And Gary, obviously, we were talking about the policy challenges. Let's shift to the 2018 contest for governor. You make that kind of the combination title of the book. Why that, and what did you make out of what happened this past November?
Sure. Well, I incorporated the entire contest, you know, for the nomination for within both parties, and which then included, of course, the conventions and the primaries, and then on to the general election between Lamont and Stefanowski and Oz Grebel included. But I wanted to really take the reader from the policy problems to the contest and the individuals as they were addressing these issues in the campaign. And so we had a fascinating contest. I will say it was absolutely terrific as a writer to cover what went on. You know, the contest within the Democratic Party between Lamont and Ganim, that itself was very interesting. And then all of the candidates that ran within the Republican Party and you know, the different views that we had, and it was so porous and so open. And another part of this book shows not just how we go about electing governors and how they have responded to the issues, but I think what's also evident in the second half of this book is just how our politics has changed and how races for an office such as governor have become so porous and so open. And, you know, Bob Stefanowski, for example, petitioned his way onto the primary ballot.
I thought he had no shot. I thought Mark Boughton was in the best position to run. But then again, he wasn't, as you probably cover in the book. Mark Boughton was not pure enough, quote unquote, for some of the Republicans in a state that's hardly a right-wing state.
No, that's right. And, you know, Republicans in Connecticut, they like the business model of a candidate, that is. You know, they like individuals who have that business background, not people who have served years and years, you know, as mayor of a city or whatever. I mean, you just look at some of the people that are being nominated within the Republican Party these days for statewide office.
Yeah.
And you've got Bob Stefanowski, you know, you got Linda McMahon, who was nominated twice to run for Senate. You had Tom Foley, you know, who
These
are all people who did not hold public office. And the Republicans seem to like the outsider.
And they come from a part of the state, and we love Fairfield County, obviously, Gary, but they come from a part of the state, whether it's Linda or Tom Foley twice or even on the Democratic side, you know, Dan Malloy and Ned Lamont. They come from a part of the state that is about as demographically and financially detached from the other seven counties as you could possibly be. I've never been able in the last generation or so to figure out why, for example, Greater New Haven or Greater Hartford area politicals or somebody from out east doesn't get the juice they should on a statewide level.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with their resources. Of course, you know, Stefanowski, though, is from Madison, which was somewhat different.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you're right. So many of the candidates have come out of Fairfield County, and so many of them have the wealth and the resources needed. I mean, Ned Lamont was a self-funder.
Oh, yeah.
That's one reason why, you know, he cleared the field so quickly, is because people knew that he had an unlimited war chest. And even though Joe Ganim qualified for the primary by way of petition, you know, it was evident that Lamont, I mean, he had a lock on this thing all along. And again, it's, you know, both Lamont and Stefanowski and then some of the other Republicans I mentioned, they're very high on these people because they have an extraordinary amount of resources necessary to wage a statewide campaign. That's not to say all of them are self-funders, and some have used the citizens election funds too. But nevertheless, there is that notion that you need a lot of money to win a statewide election, and so you know, there seems to be this deference to wealth within both parties.
Well, it's a mother's milk. I mean, Gary, I worked on a couple of campaigns, and I remember being, you know, we'd have our weekly or twice weekly meetings, you know, the kitchen cabinet, and what's the first question? How much money do we have? That's it. I mean, how much money? So, Gary Rose, as we go forward here with still maybe a special session coming up for tolls, and who knows what's going to happen with another casino and all these other issues heading forward, where does the state go from here? I mean, obviously, we're looking at yet another election cycle for the General Assembly coming up in a mere matter of months. I know you say we're at a crossroads, but do you foresee any sort of progress at digging ourselves out of the hole here?
Well, you know, you have to look at the... you know, the first year of the Lamont administration here, and what have been the priorities. And the priorities are not consistent with some of the issues that I certainly have raised in this book. Raising the minimum wage, you know, it sounds great. Is that really the fix? Paid family leave, extending sales tax on various items, you know, and now tolls. Those are all Band-Aids, really, in my view. I'm not even sure they're Band-Aids. But it doesn't seem really as if... And I know he has been talking about pensions, and he has done some negotiating there with CBAC. But nevertheless, I don't think that the governor in his first year here has really... I don't think he's recruited the right people around him to really say this is what we have to do. And so it's just been a lot of small ticket items that he has addressed and not the big picture.
The release I got from the school, the info I got before I called you on this, said that you were going to be sending copies to the governors, to all the legislators. Are you worried they're going to throw them back at you?
Yeah, well, the copy has gone up to Ned Lamont.
All right,
I haven't heard back yet.
So you won't be staying up at night with a hot cup of tea waiting for your phone to ring, is what you're saying, Gary. That's what you're saying.
Right.
Maybe, you know what? Who knows? Maybe he gives you a call and says, let's sit down and talk. We got about a minute left, Gary. If Ned Lamont said, Gary, this is interesting, let's talk, and he sat down, hey, nice to meet you, what would be the first thing you would say to him if he was sitting across from you?
I would say, you know, which chapter in the book do you think is the most important? And the first part of the book, particularly the policy issues, and I think we would go with that, because every one of those issues, entitlements, infrastructure, taxes, you know, the business climate, I would say, you know, let's start working on these issues, and which one of these do you think you are most capable of addressing as governor, and let's go there. Let's begin with that. I know that you can't, you know, address everything at once. I mean, that's not the way government works, but you can start focusing on specific items and start slowly but surely turning things around. And so that's what I would say to him. I'd say, which one of these issues do you think is the most important, and what are you going to do about it?
And I know you're going to have some panel discussions on this coming up in the fall at school, so I'll look forward to that. Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University political science professor, name of the book, Connecticut in Crisis, Policy Challenges and the 2018 Contest for Governor. Gary, as always, good to talk with you. We'll hook up again down the line.
Okay, Paul.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. There it is, folks. Connecticut in Crisis, Policy Challenges and the 2018 Contest for Governor. Let's get another learned opinion on this. Far better than me to pontificate on it. Professor Bill Dunlop, Quinnipiac University School of Law, Constitutional Law, one of his forays. Bill, how are you?
All right. Nice to talk to you again.
Bill, did you have a large bowl of munchies and a few beverages today while you were watching the hearings?
Actually, I was listening to it in the car.
Yeah, excellent. Well, Radio Man, there you go. We love
you
it.
Bet.
Well, Bill, did this, I read during the week that even Democrats admitted part of the reason to do this was just to get Mueller's voice on stuff, just to have him respond in voice. We didn't really find out anything new today, or did we?
Well, I don't think there was a whole lot new, but they knew that from the very beginning.
Yeah.
The first time the Democratic committee invited Attorney Mueller to speak, he said, I'm not going to go beyond the points that were in the report. And that's exactly what he did. He never went beyond that.
Well, and I think there's a legal reason for that, right? He doesn't want to go up there as a guy who was supposed to be, right, a quote-unquote independent counsel and start kind of pontificating and speculating, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. He was taking his role as a prosecutor very seriously. The statute and the regulations that created the position make it very much like a federal prosecutor's position. And you never hear federal prosecutors or even state prosecutors going out and talking about this kind of process in the kind of detail that a lot of the people on both sides were looking for.
So now, I mean, obviously, what happens? The question is, I mean, obviously, they're trying to keep this door open of obstruction of justice, Bill. And you and I both know, because you've handled this, in your career, and I've read so much about this, that obstruction may be there, may not be there, but they're going to maybe have to wait till he's out of office. And from what I understand, Bill, obstruction is not a real easy charge to prove, correct?
Well, one of the main things that has to be established is a corrupt intent, an intent to interfere with the legal process. And it's almost always difficult to prove what people intended when they said something or did something.
So, in other words, and they point to, I guess, when President Trump said to James Comey before he fired him, like, something like, what was it, Bill? I hope you can see. It would have to do with, I think, Michael Flynn or one of the people that were charged with other crimes. I hope you can let him go, or I hope you can take it easy on him, right? And that's one of the phrases that they've always been pointing to.
Yeah, that's what I mean when I say it's often difficult to prove intent. But sometimes the people who are allegedly interfering make it absolutely clear what it is they're trying to do, and that may very well be what happened in this case.
And we talked to Quinnipiac University law professor Bill Dunlop, constitutional law, one of his areas of expertise. We are talking about the Mueller hearing today, which wrapped up after several hours, a couple of hours ago. Bill, if you are the Democrats and you want to make maximum mileage out of this, where do you think they go next? What's your gut feeling here?
Well, I think what they might want to do is try to put a new spin on what seems to be the general idea of what happened today. I think a whole lot came out in this hearing today with Mr. Mueller talking about the conduct that the president engaged in that could very easily constitute a crime, the amount of cooperation between the Trump campaign and the Russians, the fact that so many people connected with the campaign lied about those meetings with the Russians, which Mueller himself said is often an indication of an awareness of wrongdoing. I think an enormous amount came out today. It's stuff that was already in the report.
Mm-hmm.
But now we actually heard Mueller saying it. I think it brought it to the attention of a lot of people who had not read the report and who had only heard what the Attorney General and the President had said about this completely exonerating the President. I think it became fairly clear today, other than that simple statement that Mueller made that I did not exonerate the President, I think it became very clear that this report did not exonerate him. I'm not entirely clear as to why the Republicans, at least the people that I've seen on television since the hearing ended, I'm not entirely clear why they and the president appear to be so happy with what happened today, because an awful lot came out that could hurt the president.
And I think, Bill, part of the reason here that they can kind of just go for broke on this and say nothing here is, I think, as you and I think have talked about in the past, there's a hesitancy, I think, on the side of the Democrats to just put their foot down and say, screw it, we're going to impeach the guy. We don't care what our consultants say. We don't care what the polls say. And Bill, that's personally what I have said on this show, just in an editorial case. I think it behooves the country. One of two things here: either impeach the guy and move on, or say you're going to indict him when he's out of office. But I think, Bill, most of the people are sitting there going, well, if it's that bad with the Russians, even if it's going nowhere in the Senate, you have a constitutional duty to do something in the House.
Well, yeah, that argument can be made, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says the House has an obligation to impeach or that the Senate
has an obligation
to convict.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm not arguing with you.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying, when people say we have a constitutional duty to do this, it's
no, we
not.
Don't.
Yeah, they don't. It is as much a political process as it is a legal process.
And that's why the founders, obviously, Bill, and obviously this, I would imagine, is, you know, constitutional law 101, as I've been told. That's why they never really defined what a high crime and misdemeanor is, correct?
I think that's exactly right. They want to leave it wide open.
Those damn founders, between that and the Second Amendment, they couldn't get any more specific, darn it. That's got to be, you know, Bill, as a guy like you who looks at constitutional law, some of the wiggle room that was left by the founders when they pieced these documents together after months of deliberation, it's, you wonder why they left these gaps that you could drive a truck through, right?
Well, no, I think that was absolutely deliberate, not only deliberate, but necessary, because there's no possible way that a document as short and concise as our Constitution can think about everything that could happen in the future. So they have to leave it to future Congresses, to future presidents, and to future electorates to decide how we want to go. The framers just laid out, well, they're framers. They laid out a general framework, and we have to fill in the gaps every single day.
Bill Dunlap, Quinnipiac University School of Law, expert on constitutional law. Bill, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Great talking to you again.
Thanks, Bill. Be good. We'll connect down the road. Well, that's it, folks. And he's right. That's why you see, that's why there's a hesitancy among Democrats, at least among the top tier of people, to go ahead and impeach the president.